Welcome back to episode 2 of IBD and I. It is Michaela, who you may know from I Work on Monday to Friday. Now, yesterday we looked at what an IBD was. We kind of had a look at my journey along with Cara, Emma and Sinead's journeys as well, because there are no two IBD patients the same and we all have very, very different journeys. We also learned more about what an IBD was for anyone who might not know what the symptoms are, what the treatments are, and you know how it can affect the body. Today we are going to look at a number of other issues, such as, you know, when a child is diagnosed with an IBD and they have to move to an adult clinic. How does that happen? Because that fascinates me. We'll also be chatting to Sinead again, who will be telling us about her fertility journey and what happened. And we'll be chatting to Susan Brannick, who is a psychologist who specializes specifically in IBD patients, because there are a number of mental health issues that can affect someone with a lifelong illness, and it's only natural that that would happen. So Susan has a number of tips as to what we can do and how to make it just that little bit better.
Certainly, I suppose a kind of a model that I've found helpful in kind of understanding that, kind of having the diagnosis, is that the kind of model around grief, and I don't know, you're probably familiar with it, the different stages. And I suppose that idea around kind of a way to understand loss in a sense. And certainly that kind of first stage can be denial and shock and avoidance, and that being really normal too, you know, and kind of getting to grips with this new condition, what it's going to mean. And I guess, as you know, those stages aren't necessarily kind of sequential or anything like that. But you're not going to go, okay, I've done that. I've done anger now. I'll get on to acceptance. It doesn't really work like that in the real world, does it? But yeah, certainly like anger as well. And that anger can kind of be kind of turned in towards people themselves or turned outwards again. That's a really normal kind of process of kind of coming to terms with potentially a loss. And I suppose loss in terms of maybe a loss of the life that people thought they might have had or wanted to have had. And it's not to say that you can't have that life, but it just takes a bit of kind of recalibrating and going through that process of, okay, so now I have this condition and how I can still have the life that I want to lead. But again, there's kind of an emotional process around that, I think, and obviously kind of the kind of depression can be in there, and bargaining too, and going through those stages and kind of coming to acceptance.
Yesterday, we did speak to Dr. Karen Boland, who explained what an IBD is and the different form of treatments that are available for IBDs and what stages they go through. She did also speak of the importance of IBD nurses. They are the go-between for everything between the patient and the professor, and the IBD nurses are just, they are heroes without capes. They are absolutely phenomenal. They are there with IBD patients every step of the way. And I say this with such fondness, as one of my nurses, she's actually from Leek's Club as well. I have been going to her since I was 17 in St. James's Hospital. And when I first started going to her, I used to bawl crying because I had a fear of needles. So I would have her one side of me rubbing my arm, trying to get my bloods, and Granny the other holding my hand, trying to be okay. And it was only a couple of months back that she was like, Michaela, it's so great to see how you have grown, how you've become an adult, and just how much you've changed over the years. And it's kind of like she's part of our family, and is always excited to see us. It's always Michaela and Granny. Of course, Granny gets done up to the nines to go into the hospital for her day out, you know. But IBD nurses, they hold such a special place in every IBD patient's heart. And here is Mary Farry. She is an IBD nurse specialist. I want her to kind of explain yet again what an IBD is and what role an IBD nurse plays.
So IBD is an umbrella term that's used for mainly the diseases of ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Ulcerative colitis affects the lining of the large bowel, and Crohn's disease can affect any part of the gastrointestinal tract, any part of the gut, from your mouth to your back passage. And they're the two main ones we'd see. People with inflammatory bowel disease, they're really strong, they're really resilient. They respect what you tell them. They value your opinion. They value the way that I think we deliver the news to them. Over time, I suppose, when you're an inflammatory bowel disease nurse, you're a constant in their lives. So if they don't get the message the first time, if they miss a part of it, they learn that it's okay to come back and ask questions and ask questions again. Over time, you build such a lovely rapport with people I met in their school uniform or, you know, sending me pictures now of their babies. And, you know, they've grown up and you've brought them through so many stages in their lives. It's amazing, you know. We have to think about people's mental health. And we know that a lot of people who live with inflammatory bowel disease live also with depression and anxiety. And we know with depression comes fatigue and weight gain and weight loss. I think there might be up around 70 or 80% of people who have depression or anxiety when they're living with a long-term condition. So we, as healthcare professionals, we have to be very aware of that. Sometimes people put the bright side out. And so it's very important, again, that we ask the right questions so that we get the right answers and we get the answers that we need, you know, to treat somebody holistically, do you know?
You may have heard there Mary mention the shocking statistic that 60 to 70% of people with an autoimmune disease or a lifelong disease suffers with mental health issues. And that is something I know quite a lot about myself. It can be very hard. It can be very lonely, very isolating. And it's hard. It's having an IBD. It's, you know, you can get on with life. And there are days where, you know, you're flying it, you're on top form, everything is great. But then there are days where it's just like a ton of bricks have fallen on top of you. You know, you have all these plans and your body's like, no, you're not doing that today. Or, you know, you have to spend a few days in bed and you just feel so lonely and you're worried that people have these preconceptions of you being a flake or, you know, that you don't care. And, you know, when you do spend a huge amount of time isolated, it can affect your mental health. It can. And I remember being outside work one day chatting to one of my friends and I was just bawling crying. I was just so upset. I was like, I have done everything right. Everything anyone tells me to do, I have done, and I am so sick and I am in so much pain and I don't feel any better than when I did before I got diagnosed. And it was really hard and it brought me down a really dark wormhole that I was stuck in for quite a while because I felt like the IBD was me. It was what made me. Not that it was something that I just had.
To be diagnosed with a chronic, long-term condition, unpredictable, it is a tough gig. But I think with the right supports and the right encouragement and the right drugs that people can achieve their goals, their dreams. They may have to tailor their dreams and their goals a little bit around their inflammatory bowel disease.
Susan Brannick is a psychologist who has many, many years work in the field of IBDs. She is a clinical psychologist who specialises with IBD patients. She is there to help guide us through our journey, let us know that, you know, it's okay to have bad days with an IBD, because believe me, there are many of them. So Susan is here to give us a bit of advice, let us know, you know, why it would affect us mentally, what we can do, and, you know, what are the best things to do to look after ourselves and make sure that we are as healthy as we can be.
It's a really interesting question. I'm not sure that there is a generic piece of advice I would give. I would say, I suppose, maybe give yourself a bit of time to kind of come to terms with whatever that means for you. And you were saying earlier the kind of temptation to look on Google. And it's easier said than done, isn't it? We know that it's not a good idea. I mean, no one needs to tell anyone that. We all know that. So I wonder, maybe, I don't know, a bit of a pause too. Maybe and kind of checking in with yourself about what the need for information is. So is it about finding out information? Or is it about kind of feeling quite anxious or afraid about the future, which again is really normal, you know, and maybe it's about responding to that need. For me, the theme in IBD is that uncertainty and how we can live with uncertainty. And I think that's one of the most frequent things that people say is that there is an uncertainty at times to IBD. And sometimes we can get pulled into trying to over control to manage that, and that's not helpful either. So kind of over checking how the body is, or kind of how, you know, bowel movements are day to day. So that sort of tips into taking over. But on the other side is not paying attention at all. But I guess it's kind of getting somewhere in the middle, but also knowing that there is something maybe uncomfortable about managing that uncertainty and living with it. But there's different kind of techniques that you can bring to that. Thinking about kind of what your coping style is, kind of knowing that in yourself. So sometimes it can be helpful to have a lot of information. So if that's something that you know helps you, it can be worth kind of talking to your team about reputable sources of information to meet that need. And it might be that that's one way of coping. Another way of coping is kind of, some people might find more helpful not to have the information, but to kind of look after that more emotional part of the anxiety or the fear. So maybe kind of having that sort of conversation with yourself about how do I cope? What helps me cope better that I already know about myself, and kind of tuning into that, if it makes sense.
I mentioned in last night's episode that my IBD journey began when I was 17, which in my eyes, I still very much felt like a child. Well, I actually felt like I was a grown up back then, but looking back, I was still very much a child. But being 17, that is when you start going to adult hospitals. Now, I never had to go to a children's hospital, thankfully, although they sound like fabulous places for the family, for support, and just how wonderful everyone who works in children's hospitals are. But I've never had to experience that. However, there is a percentage of IBD patients who are diagnosed as kids, and they spend a lot of their time and a lot of their journey in the children's hospital. They've got their IBD nurses there, and they've built all of their relations and everything they know about IBDs through the children's hospital. Mary Hamzawi has spent a huge amount of her career working in pediatrics and working as an IBD specialist with children. And Mary is here to tell us how exactly children cope with it. Is it more difficult for the children, or is it more difficult for their parents? How exactly do they find being diagnosed with a lifelong illness that has no cure? Is it something that is incredibly daunting, or is it something that they just take on the chin and get on with?
It really depends on the child, and it really depends on their journey. And it also depends on whether or not they have Crohn's or colitis and how long they've been sick for before getting a diagnosis. I couldn't really generalize and say, I mean, children are children, do you know what I mean? And the one fabulous thing about looking at children is they kind of focus on being well, mostly. In the most part, kids just want to be well. Whereas in adults, we kind of tend to, if you're having an off day, you can sort of use your chronic disease to sort of wallow in it a little bit. Whereas kids don't tend to be like that. When you're in the children's hospital, you're obviously only going to be there until you're 16. Because once you've kind of reached 16 or you're in transition, you're in school, the plan is that you then move on to adult services. So usually what happens is in Ireland, all the children are managed in Crumlin. So the nurse specialist in Crumlin then arranges for transition clinic to happen with the bigger Dublin hospitals. And now they're organising them. They link up with Cork as well, at the Mercy Hospital in Cork, where most of the patients in the bigger centres that the children are being transitioned into. So they arrange meetings with those so that the children and the consultants from the paediatric hospital meet with the new consultant from the adult hospital and the nurse specialist from the adult hospital. That's a kind of an informal sort of, like, the adult service comes to the children's hospital to meet them there. And then usually 3 or 4 months later, those children then have their follow-up appointment in the adult hospital, and the nurse specialist from the children's hospital then will go to the adult hospital so that there's a familiar person there in the adult hospital when they get there. After that, then the children are managed then. That's their first introductory visit. And after that, then they're followed up in the adult hospital as per that hospital kind of protocol.
I suppose at 27, when I just got diagnosed, I didn't really think about anything else bar not being in pain anymore. So if they said to me, Michaela, I need you to do X, Y, Z, you know, while standing on your head and doing cartwheels, but it will get rid of the pain that you were in, I would absolutely have done it. So I didn't think of anything else. But now, as a woman who is in my early 30s, there are things that I need to think about now that I somewhat have the disease managed. And one of those things is fertility. And I suppose because it's a disease that, you know, mainly can affect the bowel, it does affect a lot of other areas. It never crossed my mind that fertility would be an issue. Like, I've always joked that my partner, if I was to have a child, would need to basically be a Viking because I've got so many bad genes and I wouldn't want my child to have any of those. I'd want them to be as healthy as possible. But I didn't think that fertility was an issue. And well, it turns out that it is. It's something that really, really needs to be thought about.
Fertility can be difficult because if you've got somebody who has active disease, it's harder to conceive and it's harder to carry a baby to term. And the phrase healthy mom, healthy baby was never as true as when it does apply to somebody who has IBD. If you're healthy, if your disease is in remission, then we have lots of patients who have healthy pregnancies and we have excellent outcomes, I'm delighted to say. If you've had complex disease and you've had a lot of surgeries, it can be harder. And there sometimes are difficult decisions around timing of, say you've had a stoma and you want to be reconnected again to a pouch. There can be complex decisions around that, which hinge on whether you want to be pregnant in the next few years or carry a baby. So there's a layer of complexity and planning that is not fun for a minority of people around having a baby in IBD. But it's a concern for all of them because no matter who you are, it is your instinct, man or woman, to worry about every medication that you're on and how it might impact on, you know, your child, which everyone is so excited about. So I'm happy to say we've so much information on that for both men and women now that we have, you know, really reassuring evidence for much of the treatments that we are on, with a couple of exceptions only. Second part of that is voluntary childlessness. So there's a high rate of people who choose not to have a baby who have IBD because they're afraid of giving their child IBD. And that's something where education and communication is really important so that they can make their decision for the right reasons.
It's only now that I am relatively healthy. You know, I had my surgery for my stoma in March and my Crohn seems to be okay at the moment, but you know, that doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever. It can rear its ugly head at any time. But fertility is something that I now need to think about because I do want to have a family, and I never thought that, you know, maybe the option of me getting pregnant myself or carrying a baby was something that I couldn't do. And now, as we look more into it, there are issues around fertility and IBD. And Sinead, she went through this exact journey herself, and Sinead had to make decisions that were best for her and her body. But I will let Sinead tell you that story.
They told me first. I wasn't asking them these questions. It's just that I was of childbearing age and I'm that, you know. And so this is in my 30s. And I was basically told, well, Sinead, we're going to have to remove your rectum and make your stoma permanent or else try and do a reversal. And if we do those things, because even after I had my colon removed, I was still bleeding daily from my rectum. They were like, but if we do that, you won't be able to have kids most likely, given your particular medical history, because it's not the same. I know people who have stomas and who have IBD who have carried successfully. So it's not that it's like a, hey, you can't do this, right? This is very much a person by person situation. And so for me, I was actually kind of shocked because I was like, I didn't even know that was a thing. And I was like, okay. So my seven Stuart were very lucky in that we were able to go about having a baby through surrogacy. And that's what we chose to do because I had been in and out of hospital so much. And again, we were getting these mixed signals and, you know, my body had been through so much and I was on so much medication that we just chose to have Ellie through surrogacy. They were able to use my eggs and Stuart's sperm and that's how we had Ellie. And it's actually a lovely story. And but that's why we chose to do that. I wasn't having fertility issues per se. It was just, and it was more about the actual physical carrying as opposed to the conceiving. That was the issue. We were just scared of being told at this point on three separate occasions that I wasn't going to make it through the night. I had been in high dependency, I'd been in ambulances, I'd been on a lot of different things. And then to be told that carrying a pregnancy was putting me at risk and putting the baby at risk, we were just like, if we don't have to, let's not. And again, very lucky to be able to do that. So that was our particular unique journey, you know, and Ellie, it will be three next month.
Thank you so much for joining me for episode 2 of IBD and I. It is a 3-part series where we are looking at IBDs, what exactly they are, how they affect us. And I just kind of want to let you know that they're so much more than just a toilet disease. And there is no reason to be ashamed, and they should not be a taboo subject. And hopefully, maybe, you know, this might change even one or two people's minds, and that will make me happy. Now, tomorrow we will be looking at other issues that come hand in hand with an IBD that maybe you wouldn't think of, such as traveling, insurance, maybe what societies are out there to help us and the community that's there. And, you know, it's not all bad having an IBD. So I want to look at some of the positives of it as well. So I'll catch you tomorrow night from 9 p.m. for part 3 of IBD and I. IBD and I is a 3-part series which has been funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.